how one would go about, or what are the ingredients, let's say, that distinguish, I guess, an authentic approach to a philosophy of halacha or a hashkafa of halacha. And I was trying to present this based on some of the writings of Rav Shamson Fall-Hirsch and the Rav. Again, just to make it perfectly clear, I think that these are very compelling perspectives. I'm certainly not trying to project that this is a idiosyncratic, you know, or minority view. I just think that the formulations of what the issues and problems are and what the goals are captured and articulated very well in these sources, but that they, I think what's very compelling about it is that they, you know, seem to cohere with the authentic, you know, they seem to be very compelling in their own right, and they also seem to cohere with other makoros. So these are meant to be representative, not, as I say, not in any way narrowing the issue. So what I was trying to, what we were trying to present was the idea that any philosophy of halacha is something that would have to be, to use Rav Hirsch's terminology, organic or internal, to Rav's terminology, was something that is reconstructing or an objectification, meaning that you're basically immersing yourself in the makoros of Torah, and then trying from there to structure and to formulate a worldview. And of course, since people are influenced, you know, and are the sum of all of their exposures, so no one is suggesting that, you know, it's so easy to filter out other influences or exposures. I would just say it in a different way. If a person is primarily, you know, has invested, you know, emotionally and spiritually and intellectually in, you know, trying to maximize his avodas Hashem, and especially in trying to, you know, develop a derech ha-chashiva, way of thinking, you know, a batel, ritzon chal, ritzono kind of a perspective, and he's invested in that, and he has, he's in a certain kind of mesorah in trying to do that. So then the expectation would be that his capacity to filter out, let's say, influences or exposures that are not conducive to arriving at, you know, an authentic perspective on these topics and issues, you know, has increased exponentially. Again, it doesn't mean that people are, no person and no people are infallible. But the expectation is that if there's, you know, that kind of level of emotional, intellectual, and religious investment, then the prospects of being successful in doing what otherwise, you know, becomes almost impossible, you know, increase. And then I would say that the issue isn't even to try so much, but it, because some of the exposures or inclinations that you have, you know, whether it's, again, religiously or intellectually or emotionally, assuming that, you know, your primary goal, and that's reflected, as I say, also in the effort and the time that you put in, you know, is to become someone who represents and is batel to this system, so then actually the, you know, the other influences along the way and the exposures along the way can end up being a very constructive ones. They can illuminate certain things for you. I guess that's what we call good, constructive, meaningful Torah umada. That's what it's supposed to be. It doesn't mean that everything that you're exposed to is a potential contribution or something that illuminates. Not everything that you are exposed to is conducive to this kind of integration. But again, you should, along the way, you know, if you're properly, as I say, invested, and you have, you know, paradigms, you know, who have been successful in this and who you believe in, and you believe in for good reasons, then your capacity to know what to integrate and what to reject, what to employ in a contrasting way, and what to perceive as a parallel, when to, let's say, borrow ideas, or just get to be shaped by those ideas in terms of how to articulate, or not just in terms of presentation, but even in terms of your own deeper understanding, to express and to fine-tune these ideas. So your goal wouldn't be to eliminate everything else. It would be to to be able to harness and to employ all of that, in this in this enterprise. And that's why, again, just using the two examples that I mentioned, both of whom have impeccable credentials in all the areas that I was speaking of. I think that goes without saying. But both of whom have been criticized, in my opinion, mostly by people who don't understand the nuances of this approach, have been criticized, as being victim of the very tendencies, that they critique, right? Because definitely you can easily find philosophical language and definitely patterns and things that appeal to Rav Shamshon or Fall Hirsch and Rav, and again, it could be other thinkers as well. Whatever those are, each according to his particular probably exposures, but also the things that that appeal to them. So that is all true, but that's kind of beside the point. What really needs to be investigated and explored, is whether there is untoward influence, and whether or not that influence is corrupting, in our objective, detached, opinion, to the extent that, we can judge these things, whether or not that is, undermining and corrupting, as I say, or is neutral, but is just, a way of formulating and expressing and teaching and conveying. Or the best option, whether these other exposures are actually enhancing, both the deep understanding and also the portrayal of a Torah Hashkafa. So that's really the question. It's not whether you use certain language or whether or not you unquestionably, find benefit, in certain approaches. It's the assessment whether or not that is foreign or that is facilitating and, maybe even able to kind of highlight that which is particularly singular and organic. So I'm obviously a fan of both of these great people and many other great people. So I think that they do it amazingly well. It doesn't mean that I don't have some ha'aros, or even some disagreements on small points. You would with anybody, and I say that's kind of not, the fundamental question. The question is taking a step back and being understand what is being done, and seeing as a model for other things to pursue. So, for example, what are the organic issues or the organic, materials, let's say, that should be the source or the primary sources for this kind of an enterprise. Here, too, there can be some misleading impressions because the people, that I'm talking about, the Rav Hirsch, again, other people who do this well, are not necessarily always presenting, this process. Sometimes, what we're able to call and what we're able to extract, in terms of their, their treatments of these issues, comes, from the overflow, of the other things, that they're doing. So if somebody were to sit down, for example, and to, consciously, go about, trying to, accomplish this goal, they would probably do it in a very focused and a very deliberate way. And then it's clear to me, at least, certainly in the Rav's world, and even in Rav Hirsch's world, that, you know, the primary, the first thing that you would be looking at, you know, would certainly be the halacha. The Rav's explicit about this. Rav Hirsch, in some places, is explicit about this. And you would try to be examining, you know, the details of the halacha, and especially what it reflects on the lumdus side of it. That's where it all ends up coming together. What is unique and what is singular about halachic thought as reflected in the norms and in our obligations in daily life, but especially trying to understand, you know, what is different or what is the same. You know, where's the overlap and what is distinctive, you know, about the halacha's orientation, you know, to a particular institution or perspective, you know, on life, whether that's, you know, ishus or kedusha or tahara or philanthropy, social justice, you know, medical ethics, you know, quality of life. You know, we could talk about anything, you know, shechita, you know, food, right, material, you know, material pleasures and spirituality. On any topic, so what would you would probably first and foremost really want to identify, you know, what the halacha says that is seems to be singular. Knud's tried to distinguish between some of the, you know, pragmatic parts of it, the low plugs, and, you know, the way of neutralizing, you know, some of the more extraneous challenges. You know, how do you impose such a system on human beings? Try to get past that. That's not so easy always to do, and try to, you know, put your finger on, try to be, you know, try to find a methodology to uncover, you know, what is singular about, you know, our approach, you know, to these topics. Again, the convergence in this case of hardcore, high level, you know, very aspirational Limud HaTorah, you know, rooted in, again, formal categories, the lumdus of the Shakavatarya, Havayas, Havaya, Varaba, and, you know, as they, you know, have been developed, you know, from Torah Shebichtav through the Shakavatarya, through the Gonim, through the Rishonim, through the Achronim, etc. But if you can come up with, you know, very distinctive perspectives, you know, having neutralized, but now taking into account, you know, also that this is intended to be a very this-worldly and effective and pragmatically efficient system. So again, just, many times we've noted that there's sometimes a clash between the pragmatic and efficient side and the ideological and spiritually aspirational part. Notices in particular where you have overlaps with other legal systems, and particularly where the halacha recognizes those overlaps. For example, you know, where there is a parallel of Shev Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, you know, and B'nei Noach have, you know, their laws, which, you know, the halacha definitely incorporates and endorses for B'nei Noach, and yet, you know, the Jewish component, you know, it differs, and sometimes it's just more, or sometimes it differs l'kula l'chumra because it fits in. You know, it has to fit in with the rest. But oftentimes, almost all the time, it also highlights that there is some distinctive emphasis, or in some cases, radically different orientation, you know, to things. Again, Ishus is a great example, you know, beginning with the Rambam's, not beginning with, but expressed by the Rambam's, you know, introduction to Hilchos Ishus, you know, Kodem Matan Torah Adam Pogea Isha B'Shuk Ratzahu V'Ratzahi Kivin Shenitna Torah. But that just being an example of many. Again, since we're learning Chulin this year and we're focusing on Shechita and the Kedushas Yisrael aspect of Shechita and the idea of being borrowed from Kachim, etc., that all of that as being very distinctive from, you know, a non-Jew's, you know, the history of it and so on and so forth. Again, it could be any topic. We could, you know, give many examples. We don't have so much time today, right? But the point is to try to find what is distinctive, and again, what are the tremendous benefits, you know, of the of this approach to a philosophy of halacha, is the fact that it does merge and integrates the Limudat Torah, classical Limudat Torah, on a very high level, you know, with the idea of formulating a philosophy of life. This idea that your behavior is judged, and your skar ba'onesh, is a consequence, of the world of halacha, but that somehow medieval Aristotelian or Platonic or some other thought system is really what the purpose of life is all about, is a very strange and dissonant idea. So it's something which prevailed for a very long period of time in many circles, but kind of once you become aware that it doesn't have to be that way, it probably shouldn't be that way, that becomes a very compelling argument. Not just because all your eggs are in the same basket, which sometimes is a good thing, but it just makes sense that you're being judged, and your fate and your destiny both are being determined by your fidelity to and your connection with norms, that also embody what the purpose of your life is about. It seems strange, to have this dissonance, once you think about it. So the way to go about doing it, if you were doing it consciously and you were doing it as programmatically, would be, to consciously be trying to, put your finger on what is singular about the halacha's approach to all these things in the context of regular Limudat Torah without skipping steps. And here, this is an important caution. Limudat Torah, as we know, is only, accomplished in an effective way when we pursue it with integrity. And that means, that we, before, if you're too anxious or too focused, on this additional benefit, very critical and important additional benefit, not like a peripheral one, that we want to glean from it, you can be tempted, to skip steps, and to anticipate too early, and to be, too anticipatory in, what the conclusions are going to be, et cetera. And it's good to be excited about the prospect of constructing a philosophy of halacha, but it's, it's one of those things that is the derech haruka shehi katzara. So, you have to do it properly. You have to read the texts, and you have to be, like the Rav says, you have to be reconstructing, what they mean to us. That means the Torah Shabbat, and it means the Mishnah, and it means the Gemara, the Shaka Matari, understanding it well. It means the Rishonim. It means a lot of things. It takes a lot of time. And before you can, start waxing eloquent about what is singular about the Jewish approach to, any topic, human dignity or whatever the topic may be, right, you have to invest a lot. And you also have to invest a lot, as I say, in developing a better kind of filter or a better instinct, that will help you to, that will save you, from, emphasizing things out of proportion or emphasizing the wrong things. Again, with the clear caveat that, nobody's perfect and no process is infallible. But it begins with that, and it begins with it in a very rigorous way. That's the point I'm trying to make. If you sometimes read the works, since we're talking about the Rav and Rav Hirsch, of the Rav and Rav Hirsch, you can be, a little bit puzzled by the fact, that a lot of the hashkafa, comes out of, parshanut or other things. It's really not surprising at all, because a lot of what we're reading, reflect their orientations on topics, but it isn't actually them pursuing programmatically this project. And that's the point that I wanted to make. So for people who kind of, have lived and breathed this, and they are immersed in it, and, they've, kind of been batting back and forth, these ideas and trying to hone them and understand them better, for many, many years, and in many different venues and contexts, so it just comes out. And that part of the greatness of people who are walking Sifrei Torah, and, why, I guess, even their Sichas Chulin is important, but, more particularly, the insights that they share. So, for example, if somebody's writing a Perush Al HaTorah, like Rav Hirsch is, or if somebody is, giving a particular talk for a specific reason to a particular group on a topic, because it was requested, or because it's needed, or because the framework dictates, that's what the topic is going to be, or the parsha, dictates that that's what it's going to be. So the impression can be that, the ideas that emerge basically emerging from, parshanut, or from, drashos, Sometimes a drasha with a very different goal and purpose, as well. You're speaking at a pidgin event, or a bris mila, or a wedding, or whatever it is that you're speaking at. Sadly, a hesped, so you can get the impression that, a lot of things are just, drashos. And nothing wrong with drashos. But for the great, great people, you have to still be able to filter out, because, sometimes, the theme that you want to develop is very important. And it, disproportionately plays a role. So a lot, all sorts of interesting methodological questions about how you assess different kind of material, when you're trying to, extract, patterns and perspectives, of this sort. But it shouldn't be misleading, because in the end of the day, if we're talking about the ones who really are, the giants, who do this, much of it, or most of it, no matter what the particular, specific context happens to be, still coheres with and probably, stems from or radiates out from, this more global understanding. In the same way that, we often try to show that, that the Rambam or other Rishonim, take stances on topics, not only based on the narrow, Shakta Vitarya that is in front of us at the moment, but based on their understanding of the totality of the halakhic system and of Shas and of Midrashim, and so on and so forth. So it shouldn't be, kind of misleading. It should be, understood that that's kind of what it is. Rav Hirsch, for example, even in his formulation of the challenge of this, speaks about organic Jewish sources. One of the things, for example, that he underscores as an organic Jewish source is language. And that's probably the most, that's probably the, the Achilles heel or the weak spot of, if you don't buy into a lot of his, linguistic adventures. He has a lot of theories about the Hebrew language. So it raises the question, well, how much of this is kind of, built on that? And I think that is, the weakest part of my opinion, of his, not only my opinion, others' opinions too, but of his, of his presentation. But in the end of the day, it's clear to me that the linguistic elements are a tool. It's exactly an example of what I was speaking about before. In the end of the day, I don't think there's a single substantive perspective, that Rav Hirsch, elaborates on, especially, if it's a recurring theme, that really requires, that you buy into, the linguistic, aspect of it. In the end of the day, it's very, much interconnected with how he understands, especially the halakha, how he understands much more broadly the, the parshanut. And this, this added element, you can accept it, if you believe in it, and you can be skeptical about it. I don't think it changes at all. At least for me, it doesn't, and I am a little skeptical about some of that part of it. It doesn't change the broader picture. And the same is true, as I say, in you know, encountering some of the Rav's drashos. The Rav is a great darshan, and you can, you know, marvel at his command of language and his, you know, ability, you know, to inspire, you know, and the pyrotechnics of you know, of being a great darshan. At the end of the day, you know, the big ideas that come out of the things that he said and that he wrote are very, very consistent, and they don't really come from there. You know, they're also expressed in that way, but they really come from, and again, you can make your own judgments. You have to, those are the kind of questions that you're looking at. And, you know, but if you didn't, if the project wasn't done in a systematic way, because there wasn't necessarily time to do that when people are, you know, are active, responsible, you know, rabbinic leaders, you know, who are functioning in a, I wouldn't say a time of crisis, it's always a time of crisis, but, you know, whose involvement and whose, you know, authority is necessary, you know, for the function and functioning of the Jewish community. So you're involved in all sorts of, you know, other parts of the rabbinic, you know, obligation in the rabbinic world. And therefore, you know, somehow the hashkafa, you know, will come out a lot through that. But that can be misleading. And what's necessary is to take a step back and to assess, you know, what is recurring and whether or not it isn't compelling, you know, in terms of the more primary sources. I also think that while the primary sources need to be, you know, the sources of halacha, you know, the idea that they would also be reinforced, you know, by mainstream midrashim, not every single midrash, because some midrashim were the drashos, you know, the bar mitzvah speeches and the, you know, the hespedim and the, you know, the under the chuppah drashas of the Tanaim and the Amoraim and so on. And again, that doesn't mean that, you know, the ideas expressed are less authentic, but it can sometimes mean that the hook, you know, how they come in, you know, to that particular event, you know, can be sometimes something that is, you know, more questionable. But at the end of the day, especially in mainstream things, you know, things that are reinforced, you know, across, you know, Divrei Agada and Chazal, even things that, you know, are the mainstream ideas in Jewish mysticism, and again later in, you know, Makshaba, medieval, you know, Jewish thought and you know, modern Jewish thought by the great Chachmei HaMesorah, you know, who themselves, again, were steeped in and immersed, you know, in all of this, and therefore generally had amazing instincts in terms of what to project. And even then, there's certainly a range. But these things can be very reinforcing, and they can, you know, they can help illuminate sometimes an idea that is expressed in a context where the sources, let's say, are less normative or normatively, you know, significant, you know, can still kind of open your mind and your heart, you know, to certain perspectives that you can then, you know, in turn, see and look. You have to be very careful, I think, about this. You know, in Eretz Yisrael today, there's like a whole school called Makshevet HaHalacha, which I think means something very different. And certainly as it's evolved more and more, I think it means something very different from what I'm trying to describe as the, you know, the perspectives of Rav Hirsch and the Rav, and I think, you know, the most, would say, ambitious and most authentic way of extracting a hashkafa from halacha. The words are the same, but it's, I think, much more heavily based on, you know, the machshava part. And, you know, I think that's not just a reflection in many cases, but it's you know, kind of, well, this is all, it's based on an assumption that, like, these are all organic Jewish sources, you know, and therefore they should all be given kind of equal weight, you know, and then, you know, where does that take you? And that, you know, sometimes, for me at least, can produce some very sketchy or uncomfortable or just not as compelling. I'm not speaking about anything specific at the moment, but, you know, as a school, I have a lot of misgivings. At least it's important to know that, that's not what the Rav was doing, and it's not what the Hirsch was doing, etc. So I think the difference is, you know, the as I say, the Derech Arukah Shei Katsara of going through Havayis Davayi V'Rava and understanding the weight that at least initially should be given, notwithstanding the contribution that can be made by other genres, you know, but definitely giving priority, you know, to the things that are normative, and especially the lumdus and you know, everything that goes into that, you know, which is so critical to halakhic thinking, you know, and once you have that, you know, to then, you know, carefully, you know, that's point of emphasis too, make sure that you're not diluting it too much. I'm not even talking about the consequences of it. That's a whole separate question. You know, what is the goal of all this? What are the consequences of it? I'm just talking about whether, you know, it's compelling or not, and whether it's the, in my opinion, the most authentic, most aspirational way to do this. You know, at that point, once you've done, you know, the core work, the idea of finding echoes in, you know, in other genres, and, you know, and maybe even in deepening your understanding in some cases, is something which, you know, I think can be very fruitful. But, you know, again, the order, the weight, a critical eye, you know, being a little more skeptical, you know, about those extensions, trying to figure out, you know, whether they truly, you know, do fit in and therefore expand our appreciation and understanding of, you know, like halachic, hashkafic norms. You know, I think all of that, you know, becomes a critical part. Again, the best way to do this actually is to do it. So we kind of do it every day, I think, I hope. Although we don't bang people over the head with it, I hope, also. But, you know, if you take any topic, you work on a topic. I mean, last year, in the end of the year, we were talking about, you know, Zenene, Vizela Chaser, and Kofen Osal Midat Stom, and different perspectives on, you know, that those are good places, Tzedakah, of course, Bailus. Like, these are all good, you know, very, very important pieces, you know, to try to figure out, like, what is the halakha's view of ownership? And what is its view about, you know, personal ownership and, you know, socialism and capitalism? You know, obviously, halakha is neither socialistic nor capitalistic, you know, but what exactly does it have to say about these questions? You know, the Galgala Choser, the idea that an ani is a malva, you know, in some sources, you know, that you can, you know, you owe him, you know, to support him, you know, within reason. And yet, there's something called Geneva and Gazela, where we perceive that to be, we're very extreme in our, you know, focus on the rights of and the significance of personal property, and also very extreme in Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh LaZeh, you know, in the need to be, you know, cultivating, you know, the mida of nidivut and adivut, meaning generosity in all of its different aspects, and the idea that in some issues there is like a collective, you know, Klal Yisrael fund or certain orientation, but the only way to really, you know, pin those things down, and even then you can't completely pin them down because sometimes they're complex ideas, but is to, you know, to really join the questions. You know, what does it mean to be a neighbor in the halacha? First parak, you know, and second parak of Bava Basra, you know, and so on and so forth, whether it's Choshen Mishpat. Again, this year we've been discussing really very important issues in Kedushas Yisrael in terms of, you know, Tahara, in terms of, you know, the question of, you know, focusing on physicality or on, you know, pure spirituality. You know, we're also trying to figure out, you know, whether you can believe a kuti, you know, when he does shkita, and whether you have to check you know, Sakin Shel Shchita, and, you know, whether Romitzu Neitzel Shchita, Mumkin Heim, Efshel Labar, Tarach Labar. So, on the one hand, you know, you can't, you know, ignore those things, and you have to give them their proper due, but I don't say that begrudgingly. In the end of the day, they're important, they're critical, but not only that, but if we really understand what they're really about, in many cases, they're very exciting, and they're very, you know, reflective, very significant, consequential, which is how we look at the world. You know, even Eshel Levar Tzarech Levar, which is something we've been talking about, you know, relying on Hakros, and, you know, what does it mean, you know, to, when do you need certainty, and what is certainty, you know, and, you know, reconstructed certainty, you know, infallible certainty, you know, all those kind of questions are really much bigger issues and questions. So if we take the time to, you know, if we're really, you know, single-minded in our pursuit of Dvar Hashem in all of its different aspects, and we're, you know, not in a hurry to get the answers, but we're willing to invest, then, in my opinion, the payoff is enormous. And it reflects itself in, again, the way that you understand these other genres, too. I mean, just to mention this, and I'll take questions if there are some before we start the regular share, but, you know, I've made the point in the past, so just to reiterate it very quickly, especially in light of what I said before about, you know, a lot of the Rav material that was published, especially over the last number of years, obviously almost all posthumously, very little was published when Rav was alive. A lot of it are drushes that he gave and talks that he gave, you know, and so on and so forth, which, you know, and again, same thing with Rav Hirsch, it's, you know, the Perush al HaTorah, it's, I mean, you do have Chorev, which is, you know, Tamei Mitzvos, but definitely the Perush al HaTorah is the magnum opus, and that's just, you know, and then you have the collected works, which are, you know, otherwise known as the Gezamel Teshriften, and they, of course, are topically oriented, so there's a, you know, an article about how you go about developing a philosophy of halacha. That's obviously something more specific. Although, again, you have to know who it was written for and where it was published, you know, to explain a little better why the emphasis on language and other things. But, you know, many of the essays are about topics, and they're written, you know, for some timely, you know, reason. Time of the year, you know, some issue that was, you know, very much urgent in the community. So, again, you have to, you know, have a certain understanding of, you know, how and to what extent, you know, that impacts or the issue. In particular, I just wanted to contrast the Rav's approach to Parshanut and Drashos even, you know, even with that of you know, other major figures of Brisk, especially, you know, we have the Perush al HaTorah of the Griz, of Rav Elbel, and while that is much more in the, you know, kind of line of thinking of the, called the Mishnah LeMelech and others, who kind of also were interested in projecting the centrality of halacha, even in their parshanut, but what they ended up doing often, not always, but often, was kind of halachasizing, you know, chazal, or the medrash, or parshanut itself, so that, you know, the machlokas between Avram and Abimelech, or, you know, or the Melech Sodom and, you know, and Lot, you know, ends up being, you know, about the Yushalom Midas, or something like that. Mishnah LeMelech. You know, those kind of things or other kind of things. And again, it does, some of it is very ingenious. Some of it can be very insightful to the concepts. Some of it is insightful to the, you know, to the narratives. And of course, it does reflect a very strong halachocentric orientation, which is something that I very much embrace. But at the end of the day, sometimes it can leave you a little bit, you know, with the impression that the parshanut itself or chazal, you know, haven't been given its full due. And I think at the Rav, one of the really important features of his thinking and of his life work, is that he was able to kind of create a parallel, not to halachasize Chazal or the Medrash or Parshanut, but also, perpetuate, this dichotomy, where never the twain shall meet. And he was able to, again, use halachic terms and thinking one to illuminate the other, but in both directions, and to find a parallel. And he was able to do this in, philosophic musings, and he was able to do it in Parshanut. And I think it highlights exactly, this kind of enterprise, which he, articulates, again, in the end of Halachic Mind, and definitely mentions, or in some cases hints at, in other of his writings as well. It's the idea that, that the concepts of halacha are the central ones, but that they are not only technical. They begin being technical, and then we step back and we try to understand, the patterns, of what is singular about them, and especially what it is that they convey, what it is that they transmit. That is something, which finds its parallel, in Chazal, and in, Ma'aseh Avosim and Labanim, in reading Bereishis, and in other Parshanot. I think that's a very good example of what it is that we're speaking about. I'm happy to take a couple of questions before we go on, and then we can do another time. We can actually do some things. Yeah.
When you're talking about the transition between
a very good question. I wasn't suggesting that there is a singular approach, but it's a very good question to raise. What I would say is that, again, the Rava has a line in Ish Halacha that, where he talks about, deep into Ish Halacha, right? Where he talks about Lasuke Shmaitz Alibet Hilchasa, and he explains that, for what he calls halachic men, that doesn't mean like knowing only or primarily knowing how to pasken. It means like knowing, because again, many of the topics are not halacha lemaisa. Karchim and taharos don't apply to the man hazeh. Ben soru morers lahaya v'lo nibra. It's drosh v'kabel skar. We had our own little drosh v'kabel skar, right? In the exchange of Rashi and the Rush. What was the status of Basar, Nevela, that came into Eretz Yisrael, in the transition period for Shechita, right? So the Rav says that, the Drosh V'Kabel Schar is also, subject to, Asuke Shmaitza, maybe the Hill. So, it doesn't just mean, of course, you also have to know what to do in life, but, that's important for sure. You don't want to be Nichshel, there's no excuse for that. But what he's trying to say was that the idea of Asuke Shmaitza Alib the Hilchasa, if you don't see it purely pragmatically, is the idea of understanding, like, what is the dominant view of a topic? Even if there's a conflict in the sugya between, whether it's Abaye and Rabba, or the Rambam and the Ravid, or the Shach and the Taz, in terms of how to paskin, you have to figure out, you're part of your Asuke Shmaitza Alib the Hilchasa, is to know, what to do about that. Not just in terms of, how to paskin, halacha lemaisa, of course you need to know that, but in terms of taking away, a Musar Haskel or a Hashkafa, from it. So I think in each topic you have to try to figure out these two things, more than two things. Number one, you have to figure out, what is the mainstream view in the end of the day. If indeed there is a debate, that, reflects a different perspective or different orientations in a bigger way on a topic,
You know, so which is the one that prevails, you know, not only halacha lemaisa, but in halachic thinking, if they're mutually exclusive. But you also have to figure out, you know, when they are and when they're not mutually exclusive. Like, there can be a topic where the Rambam and the Ravid, you know, debate, you know, and emphatically so, you know, or the Rajba and the Ra'ah for that matter, right? You know, and the, you know, passions are high and, you know, language is being thrown around, you know, it's very exciting. Again, stuff doesn't disturb me. I just think it's, you know, Mocham Tishal Torah. But in the end of the day, it doesn't necessarily mean, it could be the halacha l'maisa, so you have to pask it one way or another. But it could be the perspectives, you know, and what they reflect in terms of hashkafa are not mutually exclusive at all. For example, some of the things we just discussed with the Ra'ah and the Rajbah, they're not, I mean, they're mutually exclusive in some in cases for sure, and, you know, where you draw the line, but some of them actually share a lot in common in struggling, you know, with, you know, how you go forward and, you know, when you don't have certainty in your life and things that are consequential, you know, what the different alternatives are. And you know, what I call echoes are all over the place. You know, even if you pask in a particular way, you know, the fact that, you know, let's say we pask in like the Ravid on a particular topic, but the fact that the Rambam says it is surely significant anyway, for Elu Be'elu purposes, almost always. But even that, even otherwise, even in the Ravid world, you know, which gets that psak, if that's the case, there's usually some echo of the Rambam's idea. Not always. So you have to develop, that's part of the Asukei Shmaitza Aliba de Hilchos Aigas challenge, you know, in this broader way, you know, it means to know how to paskin when that's relevant, of course, that's the narrowest meaning. It means to try to figure out in the bigger picture, like what is the dominant, you know, view of the topic. So, for example, in your case, you know, the example you were talking about, Ksuvah D'Oraisa D'Rabbanan, or Rambam paskins Ksuvah D'Rabbanan, but he holds, you know, without going into details, but he has a certain view of what Ksuvah means, which is certainly, you know, seems to be a Kiyum D'Oraisa. So you could disagree with every point of the Rambam's, some of his applications, and still think, in addition to the fact that if the Rambam holds something, that's important. So that's a major, major, you know, Jewish thinker. But let's say, you know, we would say the preponderant cumulative evidence is that he's all around wrong about some of these applications. It still doesn't mean the concept is wrong. You know, and even if he's wrong about the concept of ksuba, doesn't mean he's wrong about that concept in Ishus, right? Now again, he may be, but those are things that you have to keep your eye open to and be critical, you know, about. Like if there's some, you know, if the Rabban has you know, a very socialistic, you know, view about Kofinos Almidas Sdom and how expansive it is, even at the expense of Bailus, you know, that is interesting for sure, in that it highlights, you know, generosity and responsibility. But at the end of the day, you could probably say, you know, that's a very minor view in the sugya, and that the bigger reality is, you know, you also have rights, kayecha kodmin, you know, your ownership matters, you know, people can't just ignore that, you know, etc. I think that's part. Not, I don't think, you know, Elu Be'elu is unlimited. There's a hierarchy in Elu Be'elu. There are some concepts, I think, that are just, you know, really, even concepts that are expressed by great men. We have rules to try to figure out, you know, what is idiosyncratic, you know, and what is, you know, not normative, but, you know, still, you know, very respected, you know, perspective. And usually we will find echoes, you know, that are normative, you know, even when the primary argument, you know, is something where we paskin like one over the other. But in Achanam, you have to be careful. Part of that is, when I talked about the Derech Arukah Shehi Katsara, and, you know, going about this with integrity, you know, and painstakingly in some cases, part of that is to assess, you know, whether or not the conclusions that you're reaching are Lasukei Shmaitza Aliba Dehilchasa in that wider way. You know, both in terms of, you know, is this the mainstream view of the sugya as we seem to accept it, yes or no? And even if not, you know, the details are not, you know, or the concept is not, or the concept is nowhere, or it's an important concept that doesn't apply here. But where it does apply is still consequential, maybe less consequential, maybe more consequential, depending on it. So I think these are things that we have to be very rigorous about, very aware of. They definitely make all of this, you know, even more complicated to do. But I think these are issues that we would have to be addressing anyway when you walk away from the topic. Yeah.
Maybe expand on when and how it is advisable to adapt one's presentation to a given audience, even if it runs the risk of presenting methodology that may not be 100% thorough or...
Well, the cases that I was talking about were cases where, you know, the it's not as if, you know, there was a certain consciousness or choice. In other words, your question is a very legitimate and good question, but your question is relevant to a circumstance where, let's say, I either am going about this particular project, right? As I've accepted this challenge, or I'm doing this, I'm involved in this enterprise, and now the question is, how am I going to present some of my findings along the way, in general, or I'm aware that down the line, or maybe even now, you know, people are going to focusing on what it is that I'm saying in this particular context, right? And they're going to be, you know, looking at it in terms of a broader, like, philosophy of halacha. You know, and therefore the question is, to what extent, you know, would there be a better way for me to be presenting this? And then your question is very relevant, and that is, well, what would be the, you know, why wouldn't you present it as I'm suggesting would be more ideal? And that is from the core sources, you know, and build it around that, you know, et cetera. I still think there can be circumstances that may justify that, because maybe you're trying to do two things at the same time, and you also have to, you know, speak at the bar mitzvah or speak to people whose background doesn't allow them particularly, you know, to, or the time that you have doesn't allow them, you know, to be immersed in the sources such that you could develop and they would appreciate, you know, this idea from there, but you can quote them a Medrash Rabbah or, you know, provide, you know, some insight in Parshanut, and you can convey this important idea about Yahadus's approach to A, B, C, D, or E, you know, and given, you know, where they are or the time that you have or the attention span, you know, that they are likely to exhibit, you know, in this particular whatever, that still may be a factor, you know, in neglecting, let's say, a classically, you know, all things being equal, superior, you know, method of conveying all this. That would be the answer to the question. But in most cases that, you know, that I was referring to, it isn't even that. It's that, you know, of course the people are also have the, in some many cases, have the goal of presenting the philosophy of halacha, you know, but even more so, you know, they're called upon to address, you know, a specific issue or circumstance, you know, and that what's also, you know, being expressed in the process are the thoughts of these insightful people, you know, which surely, you know, can and should and often does reflect, like, their view on the bigger questions. So then it isn't so much like, you know, like, you know, I've got to speak to this group for whatever reason. You know, and I'm doing that. Should I be saying things that are of, you know, less importance because I can't present it, you know, in the more rigorous and ideal way? For sure not. You know, so I want to be as substantive as I can be, you know, while at the same time, you know, accomplishing whatever goal, and there are many goals that, you know, that need to be accomplished at a given point in time. And, you know, it's more of like, oh, I do a little more choice, and then I'm weighing, you know, the other things. But often it's the framework dictates somewhat, or is dictated by other things, and it's even less of a volitional choice, and kahava. So I'm not troubled for that reason, though, by sometimes you hear a drusha. I prefer drushas, where the content or the substance or I prefer drushas where there's also, it's credible, where you can really think that that's what the Maimar Chazal means. Or if that isn't what it means, but, that there's an aspect of it at least, or it could be that that's relevant to the story or to the, I certainly prefer that. And I certainly prefer that the token be something that, coheres with and expresses an idea that is far more, rooted, even than the time or the context allows you, to present it. I prefer that than, something, which is just like it serves the function, and doesn't have, substance. But I'm just, making the ha'ara that there's a difference between going about an enterprise, and the overflow, and even trying to accomplish many things at the same time, where you have, all sorts of, good reasons, why you have to relate to other, genres and so on. Yeah. Believe in what? No, I don't think it was the first. I think I addressed that before. Well, first of all, John Paul Hirsch was a century before. I just picked them because they're both, I think they're just amazing at it. Both very, people who also, I also think that because they're both people who had a much wider cultural exposure, so I think that benefited them in doing this in a sophisticated way. I think that if it's done, with the right, rigorous, controls, having that wider, perspective, is something which ends up being, I think I've said that before clearly, beneficial. It also is more challenging, but it's also better. There are benefits you get from that, and I think these are two examples of it. I think it's very compelling. I think you have it all the time in the building blocks, certainly, you have it all the time. And I mean, what I was trying to present before was I think that these are two examples of people who did it amazingly, and they're good role models, for how it can be done and continue to be done. But if it didn't cohere with, what Limud HaTorah was and, what Avodas Hashem was, then your question would be pointing out something very disturbing. So I think that's part of what Masorah is too. I mean, maybe people didn't, clap on the bima and say, this is, what we're about to do. They just did what they did, You can ask the same question though about any, new direction, let's say, in Limud HaTorah, right? Before the Bali Tosis did what they did, wasn't it disturbing that no one else did it? The answer is no, because, the basic idea of approaching, problems or issues in a dialectical, way, there are plenty of precedents for that in the Shaklatari of the Gemara. It's also objectively something which, is sensible to do, and, human rationality, definitely, makes that compelling way to look at issues and problems. But, for the Bali Tosis to all of a sudden do it systematically, that was new. Or you can ask the same question about, any Derech HaLimud. People say, oh, before Reb Chaim did what he did. That's why they called him, a chemist. His detractors called him a chemist, not his. They said, it's chemistry, they were basically saying, people didn't do that before him, so what is that? And why, if it wasn't done beforehand, there must have been good reason for that. That's what you're saying here. But the answer is, in all cases, parts of it were done beforehand, Maybe it wasn't done in this, you know, same identifiably systematic way. And that is different, and people get credit for that. But they don't, in my opinion, they don't have to, you know, justify. And you have to justify yourself a little bit. But I would say kachi darka shel Torah and kachi darka shel Mesorah. That, you know, that, and sometimes, you know, there's a relationship. It can be that, like, the inclinations of, you know, particularly special chachmei Mesorah, we just have the ability to do this or see a need for it, or, you know, and again, hashgacha can play a role in what they were exposed to and, you know, and their way of thinking. And, you know, I think, you know, give credit to the Rabbanu Shalom, why not, right, you know, for sure. You know, we you know, Limud HaTorah especially, which is intended to unfold in, as Torah Shebaal Peh, so you're always going to have, you know, wrinkles. The challenge is, you know, that the wrinkles should, you know, should have continuity from the things that came before it. You know, you want there to be an advancement and progression, you know, an evolution, you know, but you just want to be able to see, like, where did this, where are the past, you know, traces of this, you know, and I think all these things are very strong. I mean, when the Ramban explains in Kedoshim Tiyu, you know, or Vasisa Yosher Vatov, that you're supposed to, you know, not just, you know, implement the details, but that you're supposed to, you know, develop or cultivate, you know, these principles as values. And when the Rambam speaks about the Lechonein Deosav, and this, they're definitely thinking about this idea. Are they, you know, stopping and, you know, taking all Hashkenim and trying to see what differentiates, you know, the Jewish approach to neighborliness or social responsibility? Maybe not, you know, but because that's a different kind of, you know, that's a different kind of a project. But I can give you, you know, 100 examples of other things in Derech HaLimud, you know, before people started writing encyclopedias or books that kind of, you know, organize halachic thinking, you know, based on categories, you know, of responses rather than questions. That was new too. So again, it is true that in every generation, when you encounter these things, there are always people who ask that question, and it's good they ask that question. In some cases, you know, that question could end an enterprise, because maybe it really isn't something that is sufficiently, you know, rooted, you know, in past and past precedent. But, you know, the ones that have survived, and the ones especially that have thrived, you know, and then led to the next things, you know, but built on it, they, you know, they're the ones that are going to Solomon prayer. That's that. This is really a discussion of, you know, that's a famous story of, you know, Rabbi Akiva, Moshe Rabbeinu and Rabbi Akiva and the Gemara Menachos, you know, which is an endlessly fascinating, you know, Gemara and Menachos, right? Where the Gemara says that, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu went to the Beis Medrash, was brought by the Rabbeinu Sholem to the, you know, Beis Medrash of Rabbi Akiva, where he, you know, started to get very upset, uncomfortable, you know, because he kept hearing all these, you know, ha'aros and kiddushim, you know, that he was completely unfamiliar with. And then the Rabbanu, you know, he was like getting really upset. And then the Rabbanu Shalom said, "Ah, give it another couple of minutes." Okay. And then someone in the Talmidim asked, you know, Rabbi Akiva, you know, he was like one of those mehechatesi questions, you know, that, you know, that kill us all, like, you know, how do you know? You know, so, you know, prove it to me. So Rabbi Akiva said, you know, said, how do I know this one? So the Gemara says that's, you know, that's when Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, felt, you know, comfortable and, you know, and he felt fulfilled. You know, he was no longer, you know, agitated. So again, the way to understand the story is not that, like, Moshe Rabbeinu, once he heard, you know, that he got credit, you know, so he was, you know, he was happy because, you know, long time since he had, you know, that's, of course, you know, anav mikol adam, we can pretty much reject that interpretation. But I think the idea really is, it's what I call the, you know, the connect the dots, you know, syndrome, you know, in a good way. Meaning,
You know, if I say to you, like, you know, how did you get from there to there? And you kind of, you know, you mention, you know, something. I say, ah, you know, then we can figure how it all came about. I think that's really what happened. Moshe Rabbeinu was hearing, you know, many centuries since he, you know, was, you know, the Roe Yisrael. And he, you know, encounters all this, you know, all these kiddushim that had unfolded, you know, since. And, you know, he was just, what he was upset about was, you know, like, here I worked so hard, you know, to transmit an authentic Mesorah to Klal Yisrael. And, you know, obviously I failed, they failed. You know, this is nothing like the material that I presented. But once he said, Allah Kalamosha Misina, it wasn't the credit. He said, ah, he got that from that. And then he understood that there was a process, a legitimate process, an authentic process. You know, that he connected the dots and that he understood that that's what, you know, entrust, you know, Torah, you know, to human beings, you know, and you give them a methodology, you know, the expectation isn't that it's going to remain static. It's that there'll be, you know, authenticity and responsibility in the methodology, you know, and that there won't be skipped steps and there'll be reverence for the past. And that's what Moshe Rabbeinu saw in Rabbi Akiva. That's true in Tochen, and that's true in methodology. Now, some methodologies are just not appropriate. I mean, again, you know, I'm a big believer in Elavei Lidibur L'Kim Chayim, you know, and in a wide range of understandings. But that doesn't mean that they're all equal. There is an asuke, like Avram's question. There is an asuke Shmai Tzali, but the Hilchasa, in the end of the day, you know, it's important, both pragmatic and even conceptual and in terms of Hashkafa Halacha. These things are not unlimited. There are some things that are not, you know, within the pale, you know, token-wise and also methodology-wise. You know, the trick is to be careful and, you know, for changes to take place unselfconscious. Like if you ask Reb Chaim, you know, or if you ask the Balei Tosfos, or if you ask whoever, you know, the Rambam, you know, don't you realize, well, they might have realized somewhat that they were doing something revolutionary, you know, a little different. But definitely they wouldn't have thought, you know, that it wasn't a natural progression. In some cases, it might have been totally unselfconscious. You know, this is just what we're doing. You know, like Yitzchak and Avraham Avinu, he thought he was a clone of his father. We don't necessarily think that. You know, and Yaakov thought he was a clone of his father. And we definitely don't think that. You know, but we definitely can see the progression. Right? So that's true in Derech HaLimud, and that's true in enterprises that are valuable, too. So really all we're talking about is, instead of, you know, deriving your purpose, you know, and your values, you know, from one source, and, you know, having, you know, your merits and demerits, you know, come from another place, we're suggesting that, like, what is there about, you know, again, and we make it clear, there are different, I mean, lo nitna Torah l'tzarif esabrios, you know, so if l'tzarif esabrios means it's all a test, you know, and it has no tochen, which is a view in Chazal, at least according to the Rambam, it's a view, it's a rejected view according to the Rambam. The Ramban says there's no such view. You know, Yeshaya Leibowitz, you know, Professor Yeshaya Leibowitz obviously thought that was the normative view, right? But that's insane, you know. And again, he was a very smart man, but he was an iconoclastic person, you know, who knew that what he was, you know, pushing was, you know, extreme, and that was part of the attraction. And, you know, this idea that, you know, that Torah is, you know, just, you know, a discipline test, you know, and that it doesn't mean or signify anything, is a very, more than contrarian, it's like, you know, super contrarian, you know, kitzoni contrarian, you know, view, which, you know, we could say is, in my opinion, is not really Elavei Lidibur L'Kim Chayim. It's an idiosyncratic, you know, view. So if that's the case, then, you know, then the next question is, well, how do you take, you know, the material you know, and the Habayis is the Bayi v'Rava, and the Machloksim of the Rambam and the Raivin and the Rajba and the Ram and the Ra'ah, you know, and the Shach and the Taz, you know, and Reb Chaim and, I don't know, the Avnei Nezer or whoever it is, and how does that, you know, how do you kind of translate that, you know, also into things that are a little more accessible, or just not even, to me, the issue isn't even access, that, you know, that are, you know, transmittable, let's say, into, you know, value principles. And I don't think that's such a radical idea, but I do think it has to be done carefully. Okay. We're good? Mm-hmm.